But that's ultimately where we're coming in the lesson, is to the passages read by Aidan. I'd like to say first that my prayer is that those of you who are here, who are seeking the truth, that God's promise would be to you, that you would find the truth. Whether that has to do with my efforts or my shame, may you find the truth in what we do today, and may you build your life accordingly. In my work, I work with incoming freshman students at a private college. And it's interesting to me, the selection of majors is a part of that. And many students come who have selected their major virtually from childhood and pursue it and do very well in all varieties of that. And it's always interesting to see what the reasons are. And some you can tell right away. I recall, well, this has happened more than once, but asking a person regarding their major, they say, well, what major makes the most money? Well, that's a pretty clear goal in life, that it's not so much the work, it's not so much what you accomplish, it's the reward you get so you can retire quickly and then go on doing what you want. And then there are those who are very serious and want to become an architect or a doctor or something of that nature, where they virtually give their life to that career. In Ecclesiastes, that's what is dealt with to a large extent. There's a running theme about what can you do, what can you do on this earth that is going to have a lasting reward. And I'd like to start where Ecclesiastes starts. We've just finished where it finished a moment ago. But Ecclesiastes is unlike the books preceding it, Proverbs, and Job, and Ezra, and Nehemiah. You could look at the title and you could know what that was about, but Ecclesiastes is not a term that's in our common vocabulary. Ecclesia is one that you're familiar with, knowing as, meaning assembly. Now, it is a form of that word, and it is an assembly that has been called, in this case, by a preacher, and he's going to impart wisdom to them that will be helpful in redirecting their lives. So in this case, whether it is a real assembly or a figurative assembly, either way, Solomon is calling people together to consider what he has to say. And I say Solomon because in the first verse, it says, the words of the preacher, remember we were saying assembly, preacher, and the words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. That would be one reference that would suggest strongly that it was Solomon. And over in the second chapter in verse 2 and 9, he's referring to himself, as he said, then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. And by other references within that, it can be pretty well stated that it was Solomon who was speaking. Well, here is Solomon, and he's wanting to give information to people that will help them with their lives. And here's what he says. He starts off by saying, vanities of vanities, says the preacher, vanities of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? Very, very strong language coming out. He doesn't just say vanities, but he says it twice. And then he repeats it again. So he has a theme that he powerfully wants to drive home, that vanity is what we're talking about as related to an advantage of man gaining from his work. What does man gain from his work on earth? Vanity. Now, vanity is not a word that is common in our vocabulary either. We don't normally say, well, that's vanity. But there are words that we use that are derived from that same word that we use commonly. Someone here might say, well, I saw Phil out in the parking lot working on his car for 2 hours, but he worked in vain because it still did not start. So in vain, meaning that all that labor came to no reward. And that's what he's stressing here, vanity of vanities. What advantage does a man have in all his work which he does under the sun? Suggesting that it's going to come to no reward. Strong statement. So we have to examine the credentials of Solomon. Does he have credentials to make a statement about this? Well, I should say so. We know, first of all, that he had the greatest wisdom. By the hand of God, he had this wisdom. Also, when you look at, well, he had the wisdom to make such a decision, but he also had the experience to make such a decision. He's talking about earthly gain and earthly labor. Well, he labored a good deal. We may not think of it as labor, but if we look over in chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, he says in verse 4, I enlarged my works, I built houses for myself, I planted vineyards for myself, I made gardens and parks and planted them, all kinds of fruit trees, and I made ponds of water. And he goes on and on about the slaves that he brought in and all the things that he brought in for his pleasure. All of these were works. And then he concluded, thus I considered all my activities. This is in verse 11. Which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. Here he's saying, he had it all. He had wisdom. He built all of these things. He could do anything he wanted to do as compared to anyone on earth at that time. And here he's saying, there was no profit to it. We looked at that word vanity. Let's look at that other word here. It says, striving after the wind. Striving after the wind. Vanity, being in vain. We don't use the word striving after the wind very much, but we might think of it as trying to catch the wind. And I hope Jim Shelburne excuses this, but let's imagine that Jim Shelburne brought a used, washed, peanut butter jar. And he said to one of these youngsters back here in between services, he said, I want you to take that jar and go out and stand there. And when the wind comes by, I want you to reach out and scoop it and put the lid on real fast and come back and we'll watch it go round and round in that jar. Well, that it doesn't work that way, does it? But that's a good way to think about it. It's futile, but it's the idea of capturing the wind. You can't capture the wind. And he's applying that to the situation of trying to come up with something through all your labor that you do. Now, there's one more term that we have to look at to understand what they're saying, and that is the context of being under the sun. He uses that. He says, what advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? Well, he's talking about doing the work under the sun, but he is also talking about receiving his award while under the sun. All of this that is happening that he's talking about happens between a man's birth and his death. That's all he's talking about. He's not talking about a reward that happens after death. He's talking about what happens in your life. Why are you doing all the things that you're doing? What are you going to receive that's going to be lasting? What is there going to be that you can grasp and hold on to? He said it's like the wind. You can't. And he points that out in many places further. There's a section that follows that the language is a little awkward for us. I will read it, but it's I get ahead of myself and put it in our contemporary expression rather than the way it's written. But here's what he's founding it on. He's talking about the way the world works. In verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and hastening again to its place, rises there again. Blowing toward the south, then turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along. And on its circular course, the wind returns. All the rivers flow to the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. Isn't that interesting here? He's talking about things that repeat. It goes on and on and on. And we experience it. It's been going on. It's going to go on when we're through. And he says, man is not able to tell it. He doesn't notice this. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear is filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be, and that which has been done is that will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything to which one might say, see this? It's new. Already it has existed for ages which were before us. There's no remembrance of earlier things, and also the latter things which will occur, there will be no memory for them among those who come still later. So he's pointing out the world goes on, and if you're planning on being remembered, you're not going to be remembered, and the works that happened have already happened before. They've been forgotten. The works that people ahead of you do are going to be forgotten in the future. Therefore, the works you do will be forgotten. So between your birth and your death, you don't have a lot of substance that you can hang on to as a reward for your life. Have you ever been in a situation with your job that you really get into your job and you really start putting that profession out there to the point that you're spending more time in your job and more time in your job? That happens to a lot of us, and we have to be careful with that. Because somehow we're thinking that all this work, all this time, all of ourselves that we're putting into our job is going to have some kind of reward. When in reality, there'll be a point where in your position, the desk that you sat in, someone will come in one day and there'll be someone else there. And in my case, they'll probably be doing their job better than I did. So what is it that we're striving so hard about? Think of the culture and society that Solomon was talking to. Greatness was a big part. The kingdom was a great part. And he's saying none of this really matters. None of those things that you strive for, it matters at all. And the thing about it, he said back here, I want to reinforce this, back in 8, all things are wearisome. It goes on and on and on. But he said, man is not able to tell it. I wanted to re-emphasize that. That it's going on, but we don't notice it. Why don't we notice it? We get distracted. We get caught up in things. Because the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. Now think about that for a moment. We probably have one or two Spurs fans here, and I know that there's a chance to bring in a big power forward to the Spurs, and right away we get distracted in that, and we start talking about it and what a difference in life it will be. But when you think back, the Spurs had David Robinson and many other people who have come and gone, and what difference does that make today? I've lived through 5 championships and can barely remember 2. And I was a big Spurs fan. So we have to think what we get into, what we think is really important. Is it really important? And what reward does it bring? Also, have you ever come home from a long day work and you sit down and you say, I deserve a little time off here. I'm going to turn on the TV. And you see the Smithsonian Channel and the History Channel and the Nazi Channel or whatever, World War II Channel is there. We joke about that. But there are a lot of channels you can watch, and many times there'll be something new on that you haven't seen before. And your eye and your ear are captivated, and you say, wow, that's really something. And then to prove you're captivated, they say, well, if you think that is something, you just stay tuned after these commercials, because we're really going to tell you something, and you can be dead in your seat, but you'll say, okay, I'll stay just for that one. I take the bait every time. So, yeah, the eye and the ear are really distractors. They can really take us over the hill and keep us busy in things that we don't notice down the line. What's really important? In reality, in verse 15, he is following on and saying, he's found that what is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. On the earth, he's saying, there are certain things that we can affect, and there are certain things we can't. Have you seen anyone try to eradicate poverty or to wipe out sin? I've seen both happen. The ones who try to eradicate poverty, you know, it's still there. The ones who eradicate sin typically have to kill the people who are sinning, and they'll run out of people pretty soon, I think. But those kinds of things exist upon the earth, and there are things you just can't do anything about. So we have a hard time thinking in this way, of thinking of just earthly rewards, because we're familiar with a different age. We're familiar with the age where our thinking is beyond, and we'll come to that in just a moment. But Solomon looked at wealth. He looked at pleasure. He said, does any of this really matter in the long run? He also looked at wisdom himself. Let's look at a moment in chapter 2 and 4. We read that just a moment ago about all the things that he had. And in verse 11, of course, he considered that it was no profit under the sun. All of those things that he had were no profit. Then in considering wisdom, comparing that to foolishness in chapter 2 and 12 through 16, he comes along and he comes to the conclusion that both the fool and the man of wisdom both die. Not only do they die, but he said in verse 16, for there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool are alike. They die. So he's saying even wisdom is not going to secure you a place, any advantage beyond your life upon earth. You can't. You're not going to be remembered. When you consider those parameters of life on earth, you're not going to be remembered. And onward, in 2 and 17, it shows just how bitterly Solomon received this information in his heart. Now keep in mind, Solomon was giving up a lot. When he realized, he came to the realization that I'm going to die someday, it's like I'm borrowing all these things. I have to give them up. When I die, I won't have them. And he says in verse 17, so I hated life, for all the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after the wind. And then in 18, thus I hated all the fruit of my labor, for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to another man who will come after me. So he was even bitter toward enjoying it now, for realizing that he's going to have to give it up to someone else. And who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have control. See, he's not going to have control in the future, for he will have control over all the fruit of my labor, for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. And then he takes it a little further. Therefore, I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This too is vanity and a great evil. He couldn't stand the thought of passing on his legacy to someone else who may not be worthy. So this is deeply troubling for him. And his view of laboring on earth on a daily basis, do you connect with this? It says, "For what does a man get in all his labor and his striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest." Have you ever been in that situation where your work is hard and you say, "I just get through with this part, it's going to be okay," and you're not even sleeping well at night? He's saying, that's your striving. What are you doing? Then he comes to sort of a conclusion that he reinforces that later on. But he says, "There's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? For to a person who is good in his sight, he is given wisdom and knowledge and joy. While to the sinner, he is given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give it to one who is good in God's sight." So he's talking about something he has seen that is good, that people who God is gracious to, people who are good, God affords them enjoyment of enjoying the fruits of their labor. And who can have joy without God? That's their gift to them. But then he comes back to his very sobering point, and that is, this too is vanity in striving after the wind. So he's saying, okay, so you enjoy yourself, so you have joy. You're still going to die. It's not going to be lasting necessarily. Your life will come to an end. But I think this hits another point too. It is true. God does give us that joy. And he also gives us the benefit of the fruits of our labor. And those are wonderful things because we have a different perspective. We're not looking at here and now being the only thing there is. But there is a thought within this about people who are blessed by God in their lives. I think of churches that have been established on this idea that this is the goal, that being blessed on this earth is what it's all about. You follow Christ, you give your money to us, and you will receive blessings from heaven, and you will have prosperity on earth. And they're selling a doctrine of materialism. I mean, Joel Osteen, I think, is probably one who fosters this idea that if you follow Christ, things are going to go well for you. You're going to be blessed on earth. And he's not the only one who does. But this too is vanity in striving after the wind, because it ends with the earth. There are more things too. But I think what I'll do is jump ahead for a moment in chapter 5 and 18. Here he reiterates that same idea. He said, "Here's what I've seen to be good and fitting, to eat and drink and enjoy oneself and all one's labors in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he also empowers him to eat from them and receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God. For he will," and this is quite a clincher here, "for he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart." So in this relationship that God has, he favors him upon the earth. He gives him joy, he gives him gladness, and he keeps him occupied with those things so he won't sit down and get depressed because he's going to die, is essentially, I think, what they're saying. He keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. and he doesn't ponder the years that he's facing, that all this will pass. Well, they were looking at knowledge in a different way at that time. They were looking at what knowledge was available to them through their own experience. What knowledge do I have beyond the grave? In one part it says, you don't know, for who can take you out there to see what will happen next? They were talking about a life here on earth with outcomes here on earth, not involving the hereafter. But with the coming of the Son of Christ, all changed. Prophecies were fulfilled. Knowledge came that did not exist before. God, in a sense, was explained. His plan was explained. We had information of the sacrifice of God, which we just trying to think of the best word that we observed in all of its solemn beauty, yet soberness. We had that. Essentially, we had a lot of new information they didn't have back at this time. And that new information pointed us ahead beyond this life. We sing songs like, "This world is not my home." And we have scriptures pointing ahead saying, "Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven," pointing the reward totally off what we do now in our accomplishments, but ahead to heaven. And instead of saying the product is on earth, we say the process is on earth, the product is in heaven. And that's a wonderful age to be alive in. And I'm thankful for it. And one thing we must be sure not to do is to revert to where the words of Solomon end up pointing the finger at us, that we get too distracted in the things of life. And that we give too much of ourselves to a career or something different, thinking that it's going to last, that it is of some importance. It really isn't important. Regarding our work, we're simply to provide for our family. And if the occasion arises and we have the ability to help those also who are in need. But in order to establish some greatness, it's not there for us. If you're not a member of Christ's family, you have this opportunity this morning to be baptized into his kingdom, to become a part of those who are striving on earth for their reward beyond, setting those goals, setting those things on earth aside into their proper place, and guiding ourselves according to the way that Jesus has set through his examples and through his commandments. If you are in a position of understanding that you know what you need to do to obey the gospel, you're welcome to do that this morning. If you're still not sure about things, but you're seeking the truth, there are many of us here who would be more than happy to study with you. And also, if you are of this number and you need to make something right with the congregation, this also would be a time for you to come and express that. As we stand and sing.